Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival, if this is your first session, and if not, welcome to this session of it. Thanks so much for coming out here on a beautiful spring day. We are the San Francisco State University MFA program panel, Who's Got the Power? About power in fiction, and I'm very excited. Who's got the power? We've got very excited to have this conversation. Before we begin, I just want to offer the reminder to please turn off the volume on your cell phones so that we can all center and focus on this conversation. My name is Carolina De Robertis, and I am a professor at the San Francisco MFA program, San Francisco State, as are all of the panelists. We are all members of the faculty, and it's my pleasure to be your moderator today. I want to just note that San Francisco State MFA program is sponsoring this session and co-sponsoring the festival, so it's really our pleasure to be part of fomenting literary community and supporting all of the great programming that's happening here at the festival this weekend. Also, there will be time for questions at the end, about 10, 15 minutes, so please feel free to begin percolating your questions along the way as we talk. I'm going to begin by introducing my fine colleagues and fellow panelists, and then we will start talking. So right here to my left is Mei-Li Chai. She is the award-winning author of 10 books, including the memoir Hapa Girl, the novel Tiger Girl, and her original translation from Chinese to English of the 1934 autobiography of Ba Jin. Her short prose has appeared in Glimmer Train, Crab Orchard Review, The Rumpus, and elsewhere. She is the recipient of an NEA fellowship and is an assistant professor of creative writing at San Francisco State. You're going to hear that in all the bios, actually. Her newest book, Useful Phrases for Immigrants, a collection of short stories, came out to great acclaim last year. And then we have Michael David Lucas, who is the author of the internationally best-selling novel, The Oracle of Istanbul, which was a finalist for the California Book Award, the NCBIA Book of the Year Award, the Harold U. Ribelow Prize, and just got another prize last week, which is the?
The second one got another prize.
His new novel.
Oh, right. It was the new novel. That's The Oracle of Istanbul. Okay, here I go. Here I go. The prompt is coming. His second novel, The Last Watchman of Old Cairo, won the National Jewish Book Award for Fiction and the ALA's Sophie Brody Medal. This is his most recent novel, which came out last year. And last week, it won the
Sammy Rohr Prize.
Sammy Rohr Prize. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So the books just keep breathing in new ways in the world. And his nonfiction has also been published in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and National Geographic Traveler. He was born in Berkeley, lives in Oakland, and teaches at San Francisco State University. And then at the end, we have Nona Caspers, whose new book, The Fifth Woman, A Novel in Stories, was selected by Stacey D'Erasmo for the Mary McCarthy Award. Her other books of fiction include Heavier Than Air and Little Book of Days. In 2013, she co-edited with Joelle Halliwell a book of oral histories called Lawfully Wedded Wives, Rethinking Marriage in the 21st Century. Her work has been supported by a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, a San Francisco Arts Commission Cultural Equity Grant, a Barbara Deming Memorial Grant and Award, a Lambda Literary Award nomination, and the Joseph Henry Jackson Literary Award. Stories have appeared in numerous literary reviews, and she is a professor of creative writing at San Francisco State, and she is also the chair of our department. So on that note, if you could please join me in welcoming these three. Great, terrific. So we are going to actually launch our conversation, this is not a reading. This is a conversation, this is a discussion of work and how we approach our fiction work in terms of craft as well as how that dovetails into our teaching. But just to get a little flavor of your most recent books, I am asking you to please just read us a paragraph, a tiny little morsel, so we can get a feel for the voice of your work. And maybe we could begin on the other end with Nona.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I just covered all the, you know, play it safe with time. I'm going to read from one of the final pieces in The Fifth Woman. Just the first paragraph, The Coast of Peru. The calcium in our bones comes from the core of a star. Michelle used to talk a lot about solar systems. She'd lay her books out on the floor and show me pictures, stars that measured 10 times bigger than our sun, supernovas, and the rubbery effect of black holes. Theories about infinite compression, the birth of hydrogen, lithium, deuterium, and helium. One time she told me that if the Earth slipped out of its orbit, even for a nanosecond, the oceans would roil, and soon we'd be swimming in our apartments like clothed fish. Another time she explained about the galaxies beyond the Milky Way, the colors to be found there, deeper than we could fathom, so deep, she said, that in looking at them, one would feel a lasting satisfaction. And she took my hand. She knew for certain that when we die, we become those colors, our own planetary nebulas burning red and green and orange.
Thank you.
Sorry, that was really nice. All right. I did the thing that you're really not supposed to do, which is just took a picture of my book, and now I'm going to try to read it. So if there's any students in the audience, don't do this. all right. It was always just out of reach, the promised land, always over that next rise. Still, the wandering continued, generation after generation. The same stories were repeated year after year, and always with the same hope, that the end of the journey was close at hand. After so many years of wandering, there had to be something at the end. Unless, of course, the wandering was the story, an end unto itself, in which case there was only the desert, an infinite scroll of sand fixed at the far distance with the hope of an oasis. And in 200 or 300 years, the synagogues of San Francisco and New York would look no different from this one, dusty husks of grandeur one might stop in to visit on the way to the Golden Gate Bridge or the Statue of Liberty. It was a strangely comforting thought that a few centuries from now, a group of Jews would be telling these same stories in Bangkok or Calcutta, believing once more that they had found their safe harbor, that their long journey had finally come to an end.
And I will read a short paragraph. In the beginning, he'd been afraid of falling. There were no nets. Spider workers like him didn't need nets. He knew if he fell, it would be considered his fault, and the bosses would be more pleased to be rid of him outright than forced to pay for nets that might catch his body before it hit the pavement below. But later, he learned to watch the clouds float by on the glass in front of him. Sometimes he could imagine he was flying, and sometimes he could imagine that instead he was swimming in the vast bowl of the sky, the clouds reflected before him, the noise and filth of the city lost below. But now, on this job, he was back to picking up debris, and his body hurt in both new and familiar ways.
Thank you all so much. It's sort of bittersweet because each of those pieces is so rich and beautiful in its own way and certainly reflective of all of the richness in the book, and yet, of course, can only, it's just like a little drop right from the great river inside of each of those books. I feel incredibly excited to talk to you about these books and to talk about them together in an interwoven conversation because they've been swimming in my mind so much. And between the three of them, they really span so many time periods, parts of the world, and themes. And so where I'd like to begin is with the inception of the book, the conception of the book. And one of the quotes that I return to the most myself as a novelist is, and as a fiction writer, is from the great Toni Morrison, and that Toni Morrison has said that novels are inquiries, that they begin with a burning question, something that we burn to know, and that the way I understand it is that the process of writing the book isn't necessarily about answering the question, but exploring it deeply and seeing what treasures are unearthed along the way. At least that's how it resonates for me, and I think we can certainly extend this from novels are inquiries to books of fiction are inquiries in terms of short story collections as well. So if we can kind of sit with that possibility that novels are inquiries, that they begin with that fueling, burning question, books of fiction. Can you talk about what burning questions propelled you into this project? What drew you into this subject matter in this work? How did that happen? Is there anyone who would like to jump in first?
Pardon me if I cough while I'm talking. I'm thinking that if I talk, maybe I'll stop coughing. Mm-hmm. One of the questions, and I'm not thinking consciously about this, it's more that I have this pull, like there's a magnet somewhere, and I'm being pulled towards this. And I was really pulled towards this powerful grief period that I went through, in which out of the chaos and fury and pain of grief, or within that, was also this immense beauty and these odd connects, you know, odd connects with people on the street and odd connects. But I didn't really know in the beginning I was writing into that place, but there was this sense that I'd always, like, I wanted to find language for that. I wanted to find the language. What is the language for that place that I didn't know existed? And a lot of people know it exists. You probably all know to an extent, you know grief. You know grief in your bodies. You know grief in your psyches and in your lives. And it's powerful. And so I wanted, how do I find the language for this? Can I find the language? What is the language for this? And I think that was one of the things that I followed throughout the pieces, is that desire.
For me, it was, my book's about the Jews of Cairo, and I didn't know anything about them. I didn't even know that there were, had been a Jews of Cairo when I was living in Cairo as a Jew, and I fell in love with the city being there, but felt this kind of like uneasiness being Jewish there, because there aren't now very many Jews, and at the time it was the beginning of the first Intifada, and so there was a lot of sort of anti-Zionist and conflating that anti-Zionist feeling with anti-Jewish feeling. And so felt somewhat uneasy. And then one day, wandering around the city, came upon this old synagogue. And in the process of sort of, you know, so what's going on here? Like investigating it, overheard a tour guide talking about a thousand years of Jewish history in Cairo. And that idea that there had been Jews living in the city for a thousand years really sparked the book. And it took a while before I actually started writing it. But I think the questions at the heart were, you know, what does that mean that this group of people who I feel connected with lived in the city for a thousand years? And what traces remain from that thousand years? And does that matter? You know, and also, what does that say about Jewish history? That there could be a city, which, you know, I later learned was basically the center of the Jewish world for many hundreds of years, that is now, you know, not at all. And how does that sort of change the way that we think about what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be human, and how history sort of changes things, mm-hmm. as it marches on.
Mm-hmm. For me, I had a number of questions motivating my collection, Useful Phrases for Immigrants. It's 8 different stories. So the piece that I read from is from a center story called The Body, which is a crime story, and it's based on a true crime that took place in a central Chinese city about 10 years ago, and I'd read about it in some Chinese newspapers, and it was about a human trafficking ring and how it had been broken because one of the people who was being trafficked escaped but was hit by a car before she could get to authorities. But anyway, finding her body helped break open this ring. And I thought, as I was trying to tell the story, what if there's a crime and nobody cares, right? You know who did it. You know what the crime is. You know who the guilty parties are, but nobody cares and it doesn't stop, right? The crime keeps on going. And I thought that's really what the heart of the story was, that question, because human trafficking is still ongoing. It's still about the horrible inequity in, you know, central Chinese cities. These are the people, this is about migrants who come from villages to cities to do all the work for the world, right? They make all of our things, our clothes, our computers, our iPhones, everything, and who cares what happens to them? They care, but I felt like there was this missing global question about what is happening to all these people, and what rights do they have, and where are they? And it was, I was putting together this collection just as a certain real estate developer in New York was rising through the primaries, and he was saying these very ugly things about immigrants. You know, this group of immigrants are all rapists, and this group of, you know, immigrants from this country are raping us and taking our jobs. Mm-hmm. And so that was the second question about power. And I thought, like, how do you fight that? Mm-hmm. How do you speak truth to that power when it's so big? And I don't think we have the answer even at this moment, although all of us, you know, there's a lot of us are trying to find that answer. So this was one answer, putting together this collection, try to, you know, remind people of this truth beneath this kind of propaganda. But those were the questions that were motivating me.
Thank you so much. And something I want to notice is listening to each of you is, I think, one of the common threads that moves through each of your very beautifully diverse answers is that the urgent questions come from something extremely rooted in the true and actual world. Right, like true and actual experiences of grief, like true and actual histories that you're discovering and uncovering of Jewish people in the city of Cairo, right? True and actual realities of these migrant workers. And I think people often think of fiction as made up, right? And therefore kind of divorced somehow from our actual empirical world, when in fact fiction can be an incredibly powerful vehicle for more freely exploring the truth. And it seems like each of you kind of came from a very urgent place that really has to do with real world realities and sort of planting them in the soil of imagination in order to watch them grow. Would that resonate? Does anyone want to kind of speak to that? Or
you just said it perfectly.
You said it? Okay, all right. Well, then the other thing I want to kind of pick up...
In that case. Speak to which part of that?
Any. Mm-hmm. If you have a riff on it. If not, I will keep flowing forward. Great, I will. So you brought up a certain real estate developer in New York, Mei Li, and that person's kind of process of ascendancy to position of institutional power. And one of the things in thinking about power is that there are different forms of power in the world. So there's a very real reality, which is institutional power. And it's real, and it's out there, and some people hold keys to institutional power, and other people don't. And then we have other kinds of power, community power, power from within, right? And I think when we create characters in fiction, all of those things are true. And one of the things I was hoping we would touch on, and we may as well do it now because you brought it up, I think, so beautifully, is writing in this current age and writing under this particular political administration, writing in an age in which bigotry has kind of become a much more present and visible and audible component of our social conversation and social imagination. How, if at all, has that affected how you write, your sense of what your power is as a fiction writer, your power as an author, the power you see in the lives of your characters? How, if at all, has this political climate that we're all in affected your work, your creative work?
So as well as being a writer, I'm a teacher. And I see teaching as one of my primary art forms. Mm-hmm. And I think with all of my work, and with this work, I want to move toward, right, beyond the surface, which can be easy, right? That's the media comes at it with us with the language of the surface and speaks to us with the language of, we're consumers. So a lot of the language that is directed towards us day after day after day from morning till night is we're the consumer audience and this is the language of the media. Even the media that we love needs to condense things and have a different project than what literary art, the project of literary art and language. And I feel this pressure inside of me to, and we all, as writers, we feel this, you know this, that to labor with my imagination into the places that are not easy, that are really not easy for me to go to. And that I just want to say, Toni Morrison also says, and I teach a course called Teaching Creative Writing, and one of the essays I teach is a Toni Morrison essay, and she's writing about a fisherwoman that she encountered fishing off of a wall on a place that she had just moved into down south, I believe. And she sort of sentimentalizes, romanticizes the fisherwoman at first, and then she's triggered by that to write this essay. And she talks about the resources available to us for benign access to each other, for vaulting the mere blue air that separates us, are few but powerful. Language, image, and experience, which may involve both one or neither of the first two. Language, saying, listening, reading, can encourage, even mandate, surrender, the breach of distances among us. Mm. And she goes on to speak about language and image and experience, and I just think that to do that, to find that kind of language, and then to put that language out in the world, it's no small thing. It's to think about the ways that language can awaken us, mm-hmm. to our bodies, to our emotions, to places, and imagine, right, beyond the slick surface, which really is an easy thing to grasp for. We get up in the morning, we put on our shoes, we answer our mail, we answer the phone, Carolina just gave her babies a bath, her kids a bath, and one wouldn't get the soap out of his hair.
Didn't want to,
and I said, leave it in. Why? What's the problem?
Don't discourage his acts of resistance, right?
You know, what's going to happen? But anyway, but that thing about awakening, right, like, it doesn't matter, and I'm not talking now about when you're walking down the street, imagine if we can be a little more awake, whether it's a text, literary text, or really listening to someone else, or, I don't know, fishing, paying attention to that, whatever text there is, because I don't believe that literature books are the only texts. We're always reading texts. We're in the world of texts. You know, my father was a hunter, not a reader. I didn't grow up in a literary family. There were a lot of texts outside. There were the fields, there were the cows, there were the, you know, there was the strange animals hanging on the wall. That was a very bizarre text. So But to pay it, to read those texts and pay attention to the, it's what she's talking about, language, the saying, the listening, and the reading, that it's not a small thing to walk around a little bit more awake, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit more awake while we're getting on the bus, while we're passing people in a neighborhood we don't usually walk in, while we're, you know, at a party, while we're talking to our spouses, while we're dealing with our children. And it's that... That's power. You know, I just think generosity is an amazing power, and then having access to our own emotional lives, our interior lives that are universal. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of what happens then when we don't have access to that is then it just radiates out, right? The a different kind of power radiates out, right? And we start behaving like shits. And not really connecting with each other or with the air or with trees or with somebody on the street or with, and that's not about who people vote for, you know, that's not about that. That's something larger. And then I also want to say, really, who's got the power of the black holes?
That's the truth. I've been thinking about books as this amazing technology, right? Where you're literally able to get your voice and your words inside someone else's head. And thankfully, that doesn't exist in any other form as of now. Maybe it does. Maybe someone's trying to develop it. But as of now, that's the only way that you can get your voice into someone else's head. And there's an amazing power to that. And there's an amazing power to telling stories. And as people who tell stories, I think it's incumbent upon us to be very thoughtful about how those stories are going to sort of play out in other people's minds. Because there's, you know, the leap of empathy that we make when we're thinking about our characters. And getting outside ourselves to inhabit our characters. And then there's a sort of corresponding leap of empathy that the readers make to get to those characters. And I think that those two sort of empathic leaps are two sides of the same coin. And you can really have a lot of influence, I think, on people by, you know, creating characters that are true and real, and also being mindful of, you know, trying to present stories of folks that, you know, maybe your readers wouldn't have encountered, or to present stories in new ways to make them sort of see the normal from a new angle, as Nona was saying. And so, you know, obviously that's not going to take down Trump, or maybe it is. And I think that, yeah, I really do think a lot of my students were profoundly upset after the election in 2016, and for good reason. And a lot of them were thinking about giving up, you know, writing fiction, because it seemed like this sort of useless pursuit. But to me, you know, it's the most important thing, and it's the sort of most urgent response that you can have to someone who's trying to tell these stories and trying to, you know, paint a sort of simplistic and hateful picture of the world, is to paint a loving and complex picture of the world, which is what mm-hmm. fiction does.
Mm-hmm. I agree with what both Nona and David has said, and I think that, you know, when we think about storytelling, the commercial world would tell us that this is not important, that maybe banking or finance is mm-hmm. the most important thing. But they always go after the artists, don't they? Mm-hmm. Right? They cut our funding, even though it's so small. They tell us it's not important. And once they have power, they actually imprison artists and then kill them. And I think about demagogues are very powerful storytellers. But their stories are simple, and they're stupid, and they're full of hate, but they can, mm-hmm. but they're very effective in getting people's emotions going. So it's very important to keep other stories going and to tell them for our communities and to find different ways of telling stories so that we can puncture holes in the simple stories that would demonize entire groups of people and spread hate. I think about the propaganda of Hitler, right? Very effective storytelling, completely false, but effective. I think about Mao at Yan'an in 1942 as he was consolidating power. He banned the use of irony. He put forth the principles of socialist realism, which was, in, on the surface, it sounds beautiful, and many in the left and the West believed in it fervently, like, oh, it's all writing for the purpose of solving problems and elevating the working classes, but it was overly simplified. And if you wrote complicated characters about people who were supposed to be the villain and you go deeply into humanity, you could be put into a work camp. And many, many writers were, and many writers today still are. I think it was Amnesty who said that now journalists in the United States for the first time are on a watch list for being in danger because it is dangerous to tell these stories. So I believe fervently in encouraging all of us to tell our stories and to share our stories. And in a creative writing program, we collectively work to find these voices to be so that we can hone our craft and not write propaganda, but we can fight that with truth, beauty, and love.
Absolutely. And I think that's really powerful when you say demagogues are powerful storytellers, and what they're actually weaving is a story, a story that's overly simplistic and full of hate, but it is a story. And one of the many ways we counteract it, right, is by continuing to weave stories that are truer and deeper and richer and more loving and nuanced, so that storytellers actually have an incredibly important role in times of whether repression or backlash. Right, and one of the things that I really treasure about teaching at San Francisco State and being able to be not only engaged with my own creative work, but you know, holding a container for the creative work of others and for the many different kinds of stories that are coming through and the many different voices that have so much to say, is also that San Francisco State University's MFA program is the only MFA program in the Bay Area that is at a public university. And because of this, we are by far the most affordable program, though I wish we were free, that all college education were free. You know, it's more accessible. And I think, you know, there's a relationship here. Power is about access, among other things. And I wonder whether there's anything that you have to say kind of, and this is sort of a more of a teacher of creative writing question, like in your professor mode, which of course overlaps like a Venn diagram, I would imagine, I know it does for me, with your writer self, right? There's the writer self, the professor self, they overlap so much. But within that kind of teacher creative writing space, is there anything about being part of a public institution that's sort of, you know, created to be part of the commons in teaching creative writing that that either inspires you or plays out in your classroom?
Well, so I think that what I love about Carolina bringing up this question is, I think one of the things that we don't really speak about very much or in a very nuanced, complex way in the United States of America anyway, is class. And I think that the classes, you know, I think that the different ethnic cultures and race cultures, well, there's only one race, the human race, but from way back, the African-American culture was kept away from the white working class culture. One time an African-American student said to me, it was Malik, he was brilliant, he said, I was telling the story about my mother who was pulled out of school in the eighth grade and grew up poor on a farm and had a lot of shame about not getting educated. And so she was really sure all of her children, eight, were gonna go to high school. And we did. And we went on to other things, as you can see, sitting here. But now I lost my thread, help me. So.
Public university.
Yeah. So. I think that sitting where I'm sitting at the State University, for me, was one, it's a miracle, And two, it's that place that still allows, as Carolina was saying, access, that still invites and allows people like me, or at now middle-class students, you know, whatever, to go to college. It is so difficult. And these are students who work and come to class after working and are first generation, many of them, especially undergraduate students. It's really something. I mean, I also did that, worked and went to school and all that. But that is a place of both, I mean, I see it in different ways, that so there's coming to the university, and then there's becoming a creative writing major, right? And that is a degree that a lot of first-generation students don't, it isn't, it's like, what are you doing? You need to go into computer science. You need to get a job. I heard the same things. And it's really unfathomable that somebody would do an art degree in this time. But at least it's, you know, education is there. The degrees are there. The books are there. The teachers are there who want to be teaching there. So, yeah. So it's just, for me, it's just very exciting and the place I've always wanted to be, the students I've always wanted to teach to.
You have a question?
I was just thinking you were telling the story about the African-American students.
Ah, I want to tell you what he said. God, thank you. Well, I was telling the story about my mother, and then and there was a reason I was telling it in this undergraduate class, literary class, creative writing course. And he said, and I got a tear. I teared up, and talking about my mother not having a voice, and talking to them about what they have, what this is, what it means to sit in this room, and to be able to read literature and talk about art, and it's really something. And he said, when he saw me crying, shook his head and he said, you white people, you're so ashamed of your poor.
To me, I mean, I just to sort of echo what Nona was saying, like, it, you know, higher education in general in this country and MFAs in creative writing in particular are, for the most part, the province of, you know, the privileged and the entitled. And that's a real shame, I think. And so it's so refreshing to be in a place where, you know, higher education is relatively accessible. And the MFA is relatively accessible to a wide swath of different people for two reasons. I think because, A, it's important to hear stories of lots of different types of people, not just the privileged and entitled. And B, the sort of subset of that is that I think it's really important. There's a value, even if people don't get published, there's a value to just writing your story and feeling like, oh, you know, being able to put it into words, but also feeling like my story is worth writing and my story is worth sort of putting on paper and putting out there in the world, even if it doesn't go to other people. And so being able to teach at a place like State and to encounter students, both graduate students and undergrads, is, you know, incredibly just rewarding and amazing. And, you know, if only every university was like that.
Once upon a time, universities were more like this. You know, it's by design that they've become so expensive. It's not an accident, right? It's to make it more difficult for people to get an education and then for its design. I mean, you know, this isn't by accident that we have an entire generation that's heavily indebted, right? You know, it's just to silence a generation, and so that the people who are in power keep power. What does it mean to be at San Francisco State? Some of you know because you are at State. Some of you have been through State, but for those who don't know, it's part of the CSU, which is the teaching school. And one out of every 10 college students and has been through a CSU. Mm-hmm. We have tremendous numbers of students in the state of California. And as a result, our funding has been cut year after year after year, which is amazing. And I can't think that that's by accident, right? So we have an affordable MFA program. Many of our students are working full-time. And you can take classes at night. My father, back in the day, in the 1950s, he came as a refugee from China, and he did a PhD by working full-time and taking classes at night at NYU. And there were a lot of immigrants who did that. And NYU wasn't a famous school back in the day. It didn't have the prestige that it had today. It was the immigrant school, because the president had this idea. He knew that there was these people in New York City, and they really valued education, but they had to have jobs. So he had this innovative thing where he offered night classes. And that's how my dad got his PhD. Well, we offer night classes. And so you can work full time, and you can get an MFA, which is a terminal degree. And it's not just for the poor and the downtrodden. We also have, we've got lawyers in our program. We have people who are retired doctors. We've got people who they're part of the fabric of the Bay Area, and they want to be in this vibrant, creative writing program and share their ideas and learn from each other. But they can't, take off 3 years of their life and spend $50,000 a year just to do this. Or they don't want to do that either, right? And so it's really nice to be in an environment where we have people from all walks of life, but they're just coming to our program because they just really want to work on their writing. And they really want to improve their storytelling. And they take it very seriously. And we have very interesting discussions in class. And as people say, their writing improves. And I think that's important. I think that this is how we speak truth to power. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is why people have such affection for San Francisco State. We all had to man our San Francisco State booth over in the street fair part, and so many people would come up and say, "San Francisco State, I went there, I got my degree there. I didn't even know you had a creative writing program." Or their cousin went there, right? Sure. Because, we are a San Francisco institution. And many people have had their lives passed through state or been touched by state. And that's really nice.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much. So I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we're going to move into questions from the audience. I'll keep percolating out there. So I want to actually kind of circle all the way back, carrying all of these big conversations about kind of how we intersect with the greater society and what it is to be teaching at State, and pull it back into craft and into your books. So
I was going to say, ask. Because
there's so much richness in the crafting of each of these books. They're exquisitely wrought. On a sentence level, the sentences are exquisitely wrought. And as Nona was talking about the ways that language awakens us, I thought about, so I teach both fiction and literary translation at San Francisco State. And an essay that I taught this semester in Theory of Translation is an incredible essay on Emily Wilson, who is the first woman to ever translate the Odyssey by Homer into English, and she's really has a transformative vision of the Odyssey. There's this gender look that is entirely accurate but has never been rendered before into English. And one of the things that she said is, if we agree that stories matter, then the telling of stories matters, and it happens on the microscopic level of the word. Mm-hmm. And I know that's true for translators, but it's also true for fiction writers, right? The microscopic level of the word. And each of you has exquisite sentences in your work that capture the nature of power in the lives of characters on that microscopic detail level. So could you speak to maybe a craft challenge that you experienced in rendering the portrait of a character and how you went about it?
I'll go.
Yeah, okay. Let's jump in.
I will, but not.
There was a number of different challenges with my most recent book, but the one that sort of pops into mind there's three sort of points of view in my second book. One is a sort of 21st century graduate student who is about my age, living in Cairo at the time that I was in Cairo. He's different from me in some important ways. His dad is Muslim and he's gay, but on the whole, very similar to me. And there's another character who is a 12-year-old, 11-year-old Muslim boy in 11th century Cairo. And that was a whole other leap of sort of imagination that I had to make. Like, what's someone think like in the 11th century? Who knows? But the thing that was sort of difficult in a surprising way was the third point of view, which is two twins. They're Victorian British twins. They're women, and they're both widows, and they're millionaires. So lots of differences from my experience. But the most sort of profound difference that I found was what's it like to be a twin and to be an identical twin? And they lived together, they traveled together, they worked together, they did basically everything together after they both lost their husbands. And they both lost their mother in childbirth. And just trying to imagine what that would be like to share a consciousness or some part of your consciousness with another person who is outside of yourself really was difficult for me. And I ended up having to kind of create this, what I call a plural third person point of view that kind of exists, you know, if you think about these two people, exists mm-hmm. like kind of sitting right in between them. And can go a little bit into each of their thoughts, mm-hmm. but really is a joint point of view. And then trying to sort of pull that off was, once I was like, okay, this is what I need to do, was quite hard. And who knows whether I did it, but...
No, I think you did it. It's really interesting.
I gave it a shot.
You did that. That's really interesting. I mean, you know, I always say with students that, you know, formal choices are at their most powerful when form mirrors content. Like, there's an underlying purpose. And it is the only of the three major narrative strands you have. It is the only strand that has fluidity of point of view, mm-hmm. right? Where it is this shared point of view, and it kind of moves fluidly between these two women. Of course, it reflects their twin intimacy. I hadn't thought of it consciously that way, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
So many, many places for crafting. So one of the practices that has really worked for me in terms of commitment, just really once something comes forward, committing to that, whatever that is that's dropping out of my brain and I want to follow around. Is that I started writing, and this is process, it'll get to craft, but I started writing a long, long time ago at the beginning in notebooks, not journaling, but giving myself exercises and really befriending my subconscious. It's a big part of my process and my practice. Mm. So I would give myself a little whatever it would be. It could be... a litany of an animal, you know, giraffes who read books, giraffes who, you know, dance and blah, 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 blah. And this is when I'm quite young. And I would give myself an hour of pressured writing time, sit writing, and I just kept filling notebooks. So I created a place, my experience is that I created a place in which my little ping pong brain, that I'll, something drops and I will follow it. I will have a sense of commitment to it if I think it's leading me somewhere, if it's pulling on me. And a lot of the pieces in this book came forward from triggers. I was working with my writers group, Barbara Tomash, Ann Pelletier, Jesse Nissim. They're poets, by the way, so language is I'm very influenced by them. And so I trained myself to find things and then follow things in notebooks. So many of these pieces came out, first drafts, drafty first drafts, in notebooks, and I would just have this timed session with them, and I would follow that. But that's after 20 years or 30, whatever, of practicing befriending my subconscious, having a practice that really allowed that in. Mm-hmm. once I had this sense of, I mean, I could have 12 notebooks and find, you know, two pieces that I wanted to follow around in each notebook. But then I would go to the computer, which brought forward a different kind of brain. And then I was really interested in, again, language. And so I would go back in and really look for the nuanced places and really labor. That's the other practice that I have. If something seems easy and I want to grab for it, maybe I'll grab for it in the first few drafts, and then I know that. I'm like, yeah, this is something I can just grab for, you know? Like, whatever. Almond milk out of the fridge. I was going to say Coke, but I don't drink Coke, but I was thinking about commercials. But you know that easy thing at the top, the slick surface. Mm-hmm. So then I was really, okay, so what is this feeling here? What is this color? What is this? And then I just keep refining draft after draft after draft.
I think that befriending your subconscious is really excellent writing advice. I mean, a great writing technique to really do.
It will do so much work for you.
When I even talk about power, I mean, I think about, you know, institutional power as being a very real thing to really acknowledge and be very honest and unflinching in our gaze about. And at the same time, you know, talk about power from within, what the power that we have inside of ourselves, within our subconscious, and what that can draw forward as artists and as writers. Yeah, thank you. Maylee.
Yeah? Okay, from a craft point of view, one of the things I had to think about was a lot of my characters are not speaking in English. Mm. They're writing stories about Chinese in diaspora, but I'm writing them all in English. So how do I reflect that? And I had studied previously for an academic degree with a very renowned, very famous translator of Chinese to English. And his philosophy back in the day, in the 90s, was that you render everything in Chinese into English and into standard American English. And so even names. And so he left nothing in Chinese in the text. Mm-hmm. And it was a very useful model. And so as a result, a lot of his authors from China were translated into many, many languages because it was an easy way. Once you had his translation into English, you could translate it from the English into any other language, right? Because there it is. But it's not how Chinese is spoken in diaspora, right? It's not how Chinese in diaspora speak. It's not how language is actually used, and it doesn't really reflect. And everyone isn't just speaking in standard Mandarin, you know, so why, if you render it all into standard American contemporary English, it gives kind of a flattening of how language is used. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to retain some of that flavor and some of that sense of power and dynamic when you're not speaking in your native tongue or when you're speaking in a dialect that isn't the majority dialect. And so that meant disrupting the English. And so I played with that. It's so hard to know how much to put in, say, like pinyin. I know there are authors like Esme Weijin Wang who put, you know, Chinese characters in her text and doesn't care. If you can't read it, too bad, you know. But mm-hmm. she mixes it up that way. Mm-hmm. So I deliberately kept certain things untranslated. I deliberately, in one story, there's a dialogue between a mother and a daughter. And when the mother is speaking in grammatically correct English, you know she's actually speaking in Chinese. And the way to reflect that is like, and then the daughters, when she's speaking to the mother, she suddenly gets very, very simple as opposed to what's going on in her head. And that's because she's having to speak in Chinese and she can only speak very simply, like a child. And so that kind of reinforces the power dynamic between the mother and daughter. So I tried to find these ways to show how, if this were all in Chinese, you would get a sense of that texture, even though I'm writing in English. So it's a step removed, but otherwise, how do we communicate if it's not in English? So,
I want to say something about that mm-hmm. because one, it's so it's really moving in Maylee's book that the interior and then the spoken you know, what someone is saying, but then we get access to both. And mm-hmm. so we do get that experience. And that one of the beautiful things about fiction is that we can go inside. I'm different than film. It's different than to find the language for really simultaneity of emotions and for an interior life that someone wouldn't be able to say or wouldn't give voice to themselves. But in fiction, we get to go there. We can go anywhere. Mm-hmm. That's what's, right? It's so cool. And we sometimes constrain ourselves, but we can go anywhere. You can go into a leaf. You can find the, you know, if you want to be that arrogant, which I sometimes want to be, because I go into animals in here sometimes, which is a kind of writing arrogance, I suppose. But it's also, there's a power in that. There's an authenticity mm-hmm. to our limited experience as humans with nature and things. I am a little bit windy today, mm-hmm. but I wanted to say that just that we can go into the consciousness of time. We can go into the consciousness of, who did this recently? Chabon? Dead Abraham Lincoln or something. Or
George Saunders.
George Saunders, right?
Lincoln
you can go
Bardo.
Anywhere. Mm-hmm. And we really constrain ourselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You really think about that. A couch has life of some kind. It's not sentient. Don't get me wrong. I'm not insane. But there is some kind of relationship, I say this, between a couch and air and our perception.
We can do absolutely anything in the world of fiction as long yeah. as that world is, as long, we can do absolutely
well, sure.
anything as long as that world is internally consistent with itself.
Yes.
Has to have a logic, an internal logic that is internally consistent. And that's all we need.
Yes.
And there is a really powerful, I do agree with you that fiction is of all the magnificent art forms available to us as human beings. Fiction is the art form that is best positioned to explore the consciousness of human beings, what it is on the interior. And I think bringing it back to your work, Mei Li, I think it's really inspiring for me to hear kind of what your process was with shaping that on a craft level, because I find it so inspiring in your characters, the way that they speak, kind of the lexicon that you selected for each of them to make their voices really real. And that is a challenge to write across languages. Like I know for me in my novels, my characters are speaking not just in Spanish, but in Rio Platense Spanish, like in Uruguay, the Uruguayans, and how to render that specificity. And you do it in this way that is so magnificent. And we also have been having those conversations actually in my fiction workshop this very spring, and some people in this room are in that fiction workshop, right? We have been having these very conversations because more than one student in the class with an immigrant background has been writing characters who are speaking to each other in various languages, and we've had a lot of conversations about how to render it and the broad spectrum of aesthetic possibilities that's available to us. Like, it's really interesting to hear about your mentor from the 90s and the many different ways that it can be done. We have an alumna of our program, Juliana Delgado Lopera, who is already a published and accomplished poet, but is coming out with her first novel next year, Fiebre Tropical, and that's the title in English, Fiebre Tropical. And I've had the good fortune to read the manuscript, and it's absolutely, you know, just phenomenal and radiant, and it's written in Spanglish, and she's very explicit about having written it in Spanglish, and it's really just a wild, beautiful ride to read. Of course, for me, it's one thing reading it and having Spanish in my consciousness, but I think it's a different experience where she just kind of welcomes everyone in to hear the way these characters are really speaking to each other in this kind of queer immigrant coming-of-age story, and that's her road of innovation. It's not the only way to write, but I think it's very exciting to have that aesthetic spectrum available to us, and it's really great to hear how you just how you approached these inner lives and also the lexicon of their speech.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Thank you all so much. So I welcome questions. We welcome questions from the audience. It's a great question.
I'll start because everyone else has quoted Toni Morrison, so I will do it too. Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye.
Yeah.
I because I grew up with, you know, we grew up in America, right? Yeah. And it's always the bluest eye is the best eye and the most beautiful. And if you don't have blue eyes, it kind of sucks, right? And so when I read this book, I'm like, yes, the truth of it, the power of that. And finally, someone saying it, all these things that I had felt and internalized and just couldn't dare to speak. And there it was on the page. That was life-altering.
Mm-hmm. That is so wild. When I was exposed more to literature was, I would have been at the University of Minnesota when I went at about 20. Anyway, The Bluest Eye was one of the first texts that I took in a very first literature course, and I was terrified. I always stayed away from them. And it was The Bluest Eye, and I have blue eyes. You can't see them through the microphone. I have blue eyes, I have blonde hair, I always have, and my brain just started breaking open because I so identified with the girl, but it wasn't just about identification. I recognized what she was speaking to, and it wasn't spoken to so much. And so I was like, there's this. So it was The Bluest Eye and then a million after that.
I don't know why I keep thinking about this book, but I think because it really was transformative in this weird way. But the Matt Groening Life in Hell books, I don't know if anyone's familiar with those. I just like somehow... Someone bought them for me when I was really young and didn't really realize what they were. And so I had this whole stack of really bizarre, cynical, kind of inappropriate for a young kid books. And it was just this amazing view onto the adult world. And I kind of didn't realize until that moment that there was this other adult world with all of its own kind of weird idiosyncrasies and hang-ups. And this was just my entrance into that. And Matt Groening is so funny and bizarre. And, you know, there's so much that I didn't get. But I think just kind of realizing that there's this whole huge world out there to explore was really blew my mind.
Yes, sir, and there's a microphone making its way, and there's a microphone making its way over for you.
It seems pretty easy these days to write fiction from a pretty noble perspective, given how bad everything is. One of the candidates for president is Mayor Pete, I can't pronounce his name, Buttigieg.
Buttigieg,
thank you very much. And he was asked recently why he thought that people, poor people on the right, voted against their self-interest economically. And his answer was amazing. His answer was that they don't do that, that they have psychological needs too. And that to me sounded like the response of a fiction writer. And my question for each of you is, how do you, while it's easy for us to take the high road in our writing, how do you write about people who are unlike you? How do you write the other politically, economically, in this time of divide?
Anyone like to speak to that?
I don't know how noble my characters are, but I mean, one review said I write about bad Chinese. Because all my characters like don't succeed, and they like people fall into petty crime and join gangs, and you know have affairs and do terrible things to each other. And I felt very sad by that's considered bad as opposed to human. And it's interesting that we divide our characters into these camps, and that there is this feeling that maybe we shouldn't be writing about these people who are bad. I don't know. I mean, that's just. I was at a panel earlier today with Tiare Jones. I wasn't on the panel. I was listening to her. And she was talking about how people come up to her and hate on Celestial, who is the wife in American Marriage. And it's about an African-American man who's falsely imprisoned and his wife who kind of doesn't wait for him to get out. And she says, people will just come up and yell at her. And she says, you know, we really need to stop blaming women for misaction, you know, injustice done by the state. And I think that the way we can speak truth to power is not by necessarily writing noble characters who suffer nobly, which I think was, you know, a big thing in the 1930s and 40s. I won't name names, but I like to show, I guess, the bad people who suffer and just show why they suffer. Because I think they're interesting, and frankly, don't we all relate to them more?
So it's sort of what we were talking about earlier in terms of complexity that, and Dorothy Allison says, you know, give me the power of the whole and complex, even if it's writing about shits or writing about, you know, this or that or the other, but give my people the power of the whole and the complex. And I don't really think, I guess for me, it's just that laboring into that kind of nuance and complexity that we all have, all of us. So, I know what I have done in my life and what I'm capable of and what I can imagine and what I, so it's just going into the consciousness of that person that Toni Morrison talks about that a lot in the essay that I quoted from. She talks about the other as the self and the self as the other and that we romanticize strangers. I think that's a really sad thing in, that we would reduce. So that's my effort, and I think that's the effort of literary artists in general, is to not reduce wherever you go. Wherever, whatever consciousness is ahead, it's to not reduce that consciousness to a romanticized version in any sentimentalized or romanticized in any direction. You can romanticize and sentimentalize, a hard ass, you can go any direction. And that's the place, and that external stuff is part of who they are, but it's not the essence that we all share. I mean, we're 99% the same, and the rest is cosmetics, literally cosmetics.
Do you want to speak to this? Okay. So I just want to say thank you for your question. And, respectfully, I disagree with the initial premise that it is easy to write fiction that maybe has, you said, sort of takes the noble or the high roads or like has some kind of moral compass. I think that fiction that, as you said, is not sentimental or reductive, where you have create living, breathing, complex characters, to do it well, to do it deeply, is always hard. And whatever genre you're working in, whether you're writing a very intimate, radical, interior kind of monologue of a novel that is an identity, a demographic identity that happens to be very much like your own, that can be very difficult to do well, to write a very large canvas with many different kinds of people, including those who have very different paths of life as yours, as you spoke to, Michael, is something to do, is difficult as well. It's all hard to do deeply and well, and yet so worth the path. And then it makes me think of Viet Thanh Nguyen came to visit our campus recently as a speaker, and he was the first Vietnamese American to win to win the Pulitzer Prize in fiction for The Sympathizer. And one of the things he said that really stayed with me was, he's an incredibly deeply well-read man. I mean, he's named his child Ellison after Ralph Ellison because of the influence of The Invisible Man in his work. But he did, with all of his erudition, he said that he was, while developing The Sympathizer, was watching Breaking Bad and Mad Men. And as he watched them, he thought, wow, in these portraits, there are all of these white people who aren't very nice people, and they're really complicated, and they don't always do good things, and they get to be on camera, and they get to be centered, and we get to hear about them, and they're not just flat villains. I want that for every marginalized community, and we want to have that. So, I mean, I think on that level, it's like we are not done with that project. I think there's still a lot of pressure for those of us who are writers from marginalized communities to write either characters that kind of lift up our communities and say, look, we're worthy of dignity. Like for me as a queer Latina immigrant writer, you know, it's like we're worthy of dignity. Look, we're human. But on the other hand, you know, we have to be able to tell those big complex stories, and not until we can have our own, you know, we can have our own very complicated, messy, Breaking Bad type characters and still be seen as human and not flattened into the villains of society, only then will we really have a full-blooded social weaving of stories that really includes all people. So I think that that project is still something that is very much underway for our society and can look at a lot of different ways. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
So the 18-year-old mind is an awfully confident entity. And I know not all your students are 18-year-olds. You've got more mature students. But you probably have writers who think they're much better than they really are. And so, as a writer, you have to be confident, but you can lose a lot by being overconfident. And so my question is really, how do you work with that in your teaching or in your own writing when you're in a position where you're starting to worry that you're overconfident?
I'll jump in there. I think that, I mean, the other thing to remember is that the 18-year-old mind, or all minds, are also intensely self-critical. And what I tell my students, and what I've sort of come to myself as a way to harness my own kind of like overactive self-critical and self-aggrandizing self, is just to, you know, be aware that at different parts in the process, those different sides of yourself are useful. And, you know, when you're generating work, the sort of self-aggrandizing or overconfident side of yourself is the useful side. The side is sort of turn up. And when you're editing work and revising it, the more critical side maybe want to turn up. And, you know, that's not always the case. You don't always get the right, you know, sort of voice in your head on the right day. But I think just being aware that there are those voices, and that you can kind of harness them to the betterment of your writing, is at least the first step.
We could have one more person speak to this, or we could take one more question. Okay, yeah, no, that was great. Thank you so much. Let's take one. Thank you for that question. Thank you so much. Let's take one more question. Anyone in the back? Anyone? One of our students? I see you. Yes, Ryan.
Yeah.
Yes, Ryan, please.
Hi, my question is about a discussion we had in class pretty recently about the idea of happy endings, or just like endings that, you know, feel complete or just, or, you know, resolve plots. And especially with marginalized groups, a lot of times those endings aren't happy, you know, they tend to be bleak. And so how do you navigate that line as far as doing justice to these marginalized groups, but while also, you know, providing realistic and compelling stories?
Yes, great. Thank you for that question. Who would like to speak to that? Anyone?
May Lee?
You have many endings in your book since you have eight stories.
I have eight endings. I don't know if any of them are happy. I think it's important that we as the writer be happy with the ending and feel that we've brought our poor character through some type of arc, and that we resolve something in the story, like the thing that we think is the central issue of the story or the novel. I hate books that tie up every ending, you know, kind of the Hollywood ending. We get a Hollywood tentpole movie, every ending has to be resolved, and, you know, you see where them walking off, and they're happy, and even their children are happy, and we know where they're going. It's like, I don't know how to write that. And you can do that in books, but you don't have to. And so I think that what we try to find in workshop is the ending that makes sense for the critical question that we opened this discussion with, what is the question that drives the story, that makes sense for that question, for that character, and but not have to tie it with a bow or make everything resolved in a happy way, because that's only in a Hollywood tentpole movie.
Yeah, that's so great to bring it back to the burning questions. It's like, do I have enough of an end note in that burning question? I have to think about music in this term, in terms of this, like, how, what is the end note? Like, is it the tonic, you know, the tonic of the key that the song is in, where it's that note where you go, ah, it's the end of the song. But sometimes you could be all Schoenberg, you know, like kind of 20th century experimental music and kind of end on a non-tonic note. Is there enough satisfaction or sustained satisfying dissatisfaction, right, to just kind of be that note? So that's a really wonderful way of putting it. Thank you all so much for being here and being part of this conversation. Thank you, and thank you to our panelists.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.